recording for the Chincoteague Island Project. And we're interviewing Donald Leonard. And we're at the home of Donald Leonard on the most northerly point of Chincoteague Island. It's April 25th, 2006. And Betsy Hunt is our electronic assistant. Good morning, Donald.
Good morning.
It's a pleasure to be with you here. Tell us where you were born and about a little bit about your early life here on Chincoteague.
Well, let's start off. Okay, Kendall Jesser is recording some of the written history of the island. He was a livestock grower. Of course, in those days, the island was not so inhabited, and livestock had free range of the island. And I guess it remained that way until the maybe early 30s when they invoked a fencing law, which said you had to keep your livestock under control on your own property. So the island, Chincoteague and Assateague, has had a history of production of livestock, that is sheep, cattle, and horses. Of course, the horses have become the notable species now, not so much cattle and sheep. I don't know if it's heredity or what it is, but I've always been captivated by horses. In my youthful years, my dad's friend used to say, "Where's Donald?" And he'd say, "I don't have the vaguest idea, but if you'll find the horses, you'll find him." I've always been attracted to horses or ponies. And I started the roundups, I guess, in the late 30s, painted not only on Assateague, but on Wallet Beach. They had ponies and sheep on Wallet Beach. They were owned by a fellow by the name of Joseph Pruitt from Greenbackville. He had all the leashes and so forth on those on Wallet Beach and Assateague. And we pony pen used to involve Wallet Beach as well as Assateague. And I used to go on the roundup with the seniors as a kid. And my attraction to horses lasted throughout my life. I started with the fire company when I was 14, 15, and I was the first president of the junior fire company, which was organized in the late 30s, early 40s. So my attraction to ponies prompted me to buy this real estate on the north end of the island, which was a pasture for Grandpa Beebe's ponies in the winter months. The land was not valuable because it was considered wasteland. So I was able to buy some of it at a very reasonable price, which is not the case today, needless to say. For example, I bought the first 28 acres up here for $1,000. And my friends, friends and family said, "You lost your damn mind pay $1,000 for that wasteland." Well, the rest of the story is generally known now.
Tell about your grandfather? Now, he lived here on Chincoteague, didn't he?
My grandfather, on my mother's side, was the Jester family, and there was a... My grandfather was Lambert Jester, the son of a Jester I was previously talking about.
Kendall?
Yeah, he was the son of Kendall. And he was quite a character in his own right. He was also a owner of livestock. Not to the extent that Kendall was, but they owned what is now known as Wildcat and all of that property to the west of us is Wildcat. That was all property of Kendall Jester. But Kendall Jester was a heavy drinker, which is recorded in some of the written history. And the story goes, he drank up the property. My grandfather reclaimed some of it by paying off his debts and acquired quite a bit of Wildcat and later sold it to the DuPonts. The DuPonts had it for a hunting preserve. So I'm not far from my roots.
I'll say
right across the marsh here is where my family started here.
And how did they get here?
Now, that's a good question. I'm not rightfully sure. I've heard that they migrated here from Delaware, but I'm not sure from where.
Well, that was pretty early, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was pretty early. I'd say, it was in the early 1800s, I guess.
And tell us a little bit about your growing up here and where you lived when you were young here.
Well, I was born in what was referred to as the Rowley House. Late occupants, it was the Dennis's. It was a house that was moved from the Coast Guard property further uptown. The house still stands. But my father was, we talk about come-heres. If it wasn't for come-heres, I wouldn't be here. But my father was a merchant marine. His family moved here from New Jersey, and he came here to visit his family and met my mother, and that settled his hash. So, I was one of two children, and the eldest of my father's family.
And when you were young, tell us about your school here. Where did you go to school?
I went to school here on the island. I was a very poor student. I didn't care for school. I'd rather be out in the wilderness with the ponies. So I didn't accomplish much in my school years. I later went to, after we were married, which was after the World War II. I met my wife in Tuscaloosa, Alabama, which was her home. I was in the medical corps, and they had a hospital there at Tuscaloosa, which catered to burn patients for the most part. And I was met my wife while I was stationed in Tuscaloosa. So,
you weren't a burn patient, though?
No. I was in the medical corps, and after we came back from Europe, they had to have some place to put us, so I wound up in Tuscaloosa at what they call the Northington General Hospital. June of 46. And it was just after I got out of the service.
Well, you've been married quite a while.
Yeah, pushing 60 years.
Wow. Isn't that amazing to you? It always amazes me how long I've been married. It's gone by so fast.
Yeah. What is your wife's name? What is this?
Martha.
Martha.
Yeah. Martha! Martha! She must have gone down.
So you then, after you were married, you came back and paid $1,000 for this land. Is that right? And built the house?
My family lived on Cleveland Street, and so we lived on Cleveland Street for quite some time, and I bought this property up here in the early 50s, and of course, soon after that, when I acquired my first piece of real estate up here, we built a home up here, and we moved up here in, I think it was 1964, following the 62 storm. There was a hill up here, which was relatively safe from the storms. So that's where we picked to build our first house.
Was that this house?
No. This house we built here. We moved here in 1990. We moved there in 64.
Who lives in that house now?
My son, Carlton.
Carlton. Mm-hmm. It's nice you have your children here now, don't you?
Yeah. My uncle used to say, you don't want your children to establish too close to you. But I consider myself to be very fortunate in that all the children live up here.
That's wonderful, isn't it?
So it poses some problems, but not too bad. We're glad they're all up here and enjoy living in this area.
Certainly, that's wonderful. Tell a little bit about the early fire company days.
Well, of course, we've always had an active volunteer fire company, and very successful. As a matter of, they say, necessity is the mother of invention. Well, that's the case with our fire company. We, being sort of isolated on this island, we needed a very active fire company, and the community had met the charge. The fire company has been very active and very successful. The fire company didn't get in the pony business until, I think it was 1939 or 40. The ponies were owned by Mr. Joseph Pruitt. He was a very successful businessman, and he owned the livestock grazing rates on Assateague, and at that time on Wallace Beach. At his death, it became a problem for the fire company in that if the ponies went elsewhere and were bought from someone else, the fire company was out of business. So they were forced to buy as many of the ponies of Joseph Pruitt at the settling of his estate. And that's what put the fire company in the pony business. But they were successful in negotiating an agreement with Fish and Wildlife to allow the ponies to remain on Assateague. All the rest of the livestock, cattle and so forth, had to be removed. So that's what put the fire company in the pony business.
Whose idea was the pony swim?
Well, that, I don't know when that started, But I'm told that they used to have once a year on acetate what they called cheap penning. And it was a general roundup of livestock. And they called it sheep penning day. Well, that was transformed to what is now known as pony penning day, because they don't been a long time since there was any sheep on acetate. But it was sheep both on acetate and Wallace Beach. So sheep was as much as a part of the livestock history as ponies or cattle was. There was a lot of cattle on acetate before Fish and Wildlife bought it. In fact, there were far more cattle than there were ponies.
People used it for a range for eating.
Yes, yeah. It was sort of an open range.
I see.
And of course, the beach goes from here to Ocean City. And it was a large area that supported a lot of cattle and horses. But when Fish and Wildlife bought it, of course, they forced the removal of all livestock except the ponies. And the fire company negotiated a grazing right from Fish and Wildlife, which stands today.
I'd like to ask you about the establishment of the Refuge Inn.
Well,
when did that happen?
We built the Refuge Motor Inn in 1973. It's funny, I've often said I'd rather be lucky than intelligent. insofar as success in business. And I'll give you an example. There's just one example. I can give you a lot of where luck played an integral part in my success in the business world, however that is. Case in point is Mr. Wild Maddox, who owned all of what we knew, what is known there as Piney Island. He decided to sell some of that after he built the bridge. And he started selling some of the property. One of the purchasers of that property was, strange, I forgot his name. I should remember it. It'll come to me. But one of the people who purchased that property, Paul Hickman, he owned that where the Refuge Motor is now for quite some time, and he decided to sell it. And I gave him a bid on it. I forget what it was. It was somewhere in the neighborhood of maybe $10,000 for that portion which he owned. And that was a ridiculously low price. Of course, he declined. Later on, he got into some problems in his business world, and he decided to sell this property. Well, I didn't know it but I was crossing the street one day, down in the middle of town, and he was passing in his car, tooted his horn at me. And he stuck his head out the window and he said, "Donald, do you want that property now?" And I said, "Yeah, I'll give you what I bargained to give you for it." He said, "You've got it till 2 o'clock today to come up with the money." I said, "Good lady, how am I going to come up with $10,000 today by 2 o'clock? He said, "That's your problem." But he said, "I need that money by 2 o'clock today." Well, what I didn't know was just wanting to get that money. So if I hadn't been crossing that street at that time, I wouldn't have owned the property where the refuge motor end is. So that's what I talk about, luck. Another case in point is that I wanted to build a motel, but needless to say, I didn't have the money. I went over and made application to a bank over on the mainland, and I made out a financial statement, and I presented this financial statement to the banker, and I needed $250,000. And he said, "Donald, according to your financial statement here, you got $50 in the bank." "Is that right?" I said, "That's all I've ever had in the bank, except payday. But at the end of the month when we pay our bills, I'm lucky to have $50. And he said, "And you're trying to borrow $250,000? And I said, "That's right." "Well," he said, "you have little or no chance of getting it with your financial statement." So, to continue that part of the story, I was at a fire meeting one night, and they said, "Donald, you know Wild Matters pretty well, don't you?" I said, "Very well." They said, "Well, he got a piece of property where the ponies land, and we need that property. So would you go to Wild and see if you'll sell it to us?" I said, "I'd be glad to." So that was the following Monday morning. I was getting ready to go on the mainland and see if I couldn't borrow some money. So, but I wanted to see Wild first about this fire company deal. So I went about, and he was under a bulldozer. And he had had a problem with a nerve in his neck, and he was practically paralyzed. But he was a determined individual. So I saw his car parked there, and I could see his feet sticking out from under his bulldozer. So I said, "Wow, when you get time, I'd like to talk to you." He said, "I'll be out in a minute." Wasn't long before he scooted out from under that bulldozer. And the first thing he said to me was, "Donald, what the world are you doing dressed up on Monday?" Well, in those days, you only got dressed up to go to church on Sunday. So I said, "I'm getting ready to go off, see if I can't borrow some money to build a motel." He said, "How much are you trying to borrow?" I said, $250,000. He said, "Well, go off and see what you can do. If you can't find it, come back. I think I'll let you have it." So that's another streak of luck. Had nothing to do with intelligence. It was just pure luck. So he let me have the money. He sold part of Assateague up in the Maryland section and got quite a bit of money, I guess, at that time. And so he let me have the money. And that was in 1973. But then we get back to ponies. It was ponies who encouraged the federal government to declare this a wildlife refuge. The congressional action involved Maryland and Virginia, but I've always thought that the ponies were one of the attractions which encouraged the federal government to buy that real estate and create the refuge and the National Seashore Park. The fact of the matter is, Representative Tom Danning, who was our representative, congressional representative then, stated that one of the hearings they had relative to the ponies and the refuge, he said, "I want my great-great-grandchildren to witness the free roaming of those ponies on Assateague forever." And that was a statement witnessed those ponies running freely on Assateague forever, and that's part of the congressional record.
Amazing.
So,
would you mind going back to your trying to get $250,000? Where did you eventually get it?
From Mr. Madden.
He did loan it to you.
Yes. And I ran into trouble in which I overspent my allotment. I overspent $250,000 and I needed additional money. So I went to Mr. Maddox and I said, well, I'm running in financial trouble and I need some additional money. Would you be interested in letting me have any more money? He said, no, indeed. He said, I've got enough invested in it. And that's all I want invested in it. So he was a man of few words. He told it like it was. The first year that we were in business, when it came to the end of the year when payments were due, I didn't have the money to make the payment. So I went to Wild, and I said, Wild, I can't pay you a penny. Not one penny. He said, never mind that. He said, sign this note for it. Pay me next year. So that's the kind of man he was.
He was generous to you, wasn't he?
Yes, he was.
So you did build it in, was it 1974?
73
you built it. Well, it certainly has been very successful. It has a lovely air about it.
It's another case of ponies being responsible for the building of the Refuge Motor Inn. If it hadn't been for ponies, never would have been there.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the creation of the National Seashore Park and the refuge all combined is the reason for whatever success we might have had on Chincoteague.
We're going to stop right there for a minute.
I was a firefighter over at NASA.
Uh-huh.
Paid professional firefighter as a result of my experience with the volunteer fire company is how I qualified. So that was a reasonably good job, and it for a person who of my expertise, such as it was, we worked shifts of 24 hours on, 24 hours off, and that was 3 days a week, which in effect gave me 4 days with a free hand to do whatever I wanted to do.
With your ponies?
With ponies and other ventures. I had a friend of mine and I had built the Island Marina down there in 1959, again, with no money. But,
Is that the town dock?
Huh?
You mean the town dock? Is that what? Or Curtis Merritt Harbor, or where is
it? No, it's called the Island Marina. It's next to the Coast Guard base, south of the Coast Guard base.
Uh-huh.
It's Island Marina, which was built in 1959. My partner and I had that because we lost our jobs with the Navy. We were with the Navy and 1959, the Navy closed down. So we lost our jobs. We needed something to do, so we decided to build a marina, which we did. And it turned out that we paid for it, but it was not a moneymaker.
You've been involved in... you were heavily involved in the building of the community center and helped us, isn't that right? The Chincoteague Community Center, you established an authority to build that. And
yes. They were also involved with tourism. We tried to get the legislature to authorize us to devote a portion of our tax base to building a community center, which was supposed to help the tourist industry overall, and it may have helped in a very small way, but our appeal to the legislature was that it would help greatly. That was a damn lie. But it helped us get it through the legislature that they would authorize Accomack County to impose such a tax, a percentage of which the occupancy tax went toward the community center. And we were able to swing it on that note. Accomack County could not impose a occupancy tax until the legislature gave them authorization to do so. There was only one county in Virginia who had that authority. And it was an uphill battle because the tourist industry in the state of Virginia was opposed to it. They didn't want anybody authorized to impose a transit occupancy tax. So we had to fight the industry in Virginia in order to get authorization to impose such a tax, 50% of which would go toward the building of the community center. So it was a rather lengthy process, but eventually it went through.
It's been very successful.
Well, that depends on how you measure success.
Maybe it hasn't.
I think it has, but it's debatable. We haven't been able to attract as many conventions and that sort of thing as we anticipated, but the board has made it work with what they have, and in that vein, it's successful, yes.
Did you ever have a lot of experience on the water? Did you have a boat?
Well, I worked on the water some. I should have been a waterman, but I never did like my father's family were Swedes, and they were seamen, all of them, including my father. And getting back to my attraction to school, I said to my dad one time, I said, "Dad, I want to quit school." He said, "And go to work." He said, "Fine. Pack what clothes you think you'll need for a week, you're going to sea." So he had a two-mast schooner that he'd go out and he'd stay a week. And so I went out and I stayed seasick the whole week. And I said, "Dad, sorry if I go back to school." He said, "You got two choices. You either go to school or you go to work on this ship. So take your choice. Take either one you want." I said, "I'll go back to school."
Now, did you finish high school?
Yes. Barely.
And you didn't go on after that to school?
I went to trade school.
Trade school.
I went to Philadelphia and studied air conditioning and refrigeration and radio repair. But when I came back and tried to go in business, I had plenty of work, but nobody had any money. They'd say, "I pay you Saturday," and Saturday never came. They didn't have the money, and it was a very poor situation around here until we got involved in tourism.
And what years are you talking about there? It was very poor. Was it in the 30s?
Well, it's always been poor. they created National City Hall Park. For example, the first job I had, we hear a lot about what's happening to our waterfront condos, which is considered a bad thing. Well, when I came along, we're one of the condo projects going down was a tomato factory. And that tomato factory paid boys 10 cents an hour. So I worked down there in the tomato factory for 10 cents an hour. That was the going wage, and adults, heads of families, their wage was 15 cents an hour. So when I hear people complain about what's happening here, they should have experienced the times that some of the old timers have, and then they may not be so opposed to what's happening now. Everybody around here is, as I know it, is engaged in their trades and doing pretty well. 10 cents an hour is not much, but that's all it was, so you took it. One of the best jobs I ever had as a youth was a shoe shine boy. I was working at a grocery store on Saturdays, and the pay was a dollar from 7 in the morning to 11 at night. You got $1. So when this shoe shine job came open, I thought I'd died and gone to heaven. Because I made pretty good money shining shoes.
Now, you were a young man during those jobs.
Oh, yeah, that was when I was early teens, 15, 14, something like that.
You've worked all of your life.
And no question about that. I never remember being without a job more than one day in my life. Some of the jobs I took were bad jobs, but they were jobs. Mm-hmm. They were something. Mm-hmm. I've been very fortunate in that respect. I always had a job.
I want to ask you a question about storms.
About what?
About hurricanes and storms.
Yes.
What was it like up here when...
The storm that I remember was 33, 36, and 62. They were what we call bad storms. Of course, we have storms almost every year. But the grandfather of storms was 33, 36, and 62, in which the island was literally covered with water.
What were you doing during those times, during the storms?
Well, in 33 and 36, I lived on Cropper Street now, and the house that we lived in was well up, and the water never come in our house.
Good.
In 33 or 36, but there was a lot of water around then. Fact of the matter, the street in front of my house was over my head. In 62, we lived in my parents' house on Cleveland Street. And there again, the house was above the tide level. That's the reason that when I built here, we've got the elevation we have. We don't think we'll ever be bothered with tidal water here because of the elevation.
How high is this house?
Huh?
How high is this house?
Well, it's about 8 foot off of the ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And back in the matter, it's probably 10 foot now. I don't think we'll ever get water in this house.
Mm-hmm.
We may get it on the first floor,
mm-hmm.
which is a garage and so forth. Of course, you never know, but I'm not worried about it.
You're still actively engaged with your ponies in retirement, aren't you?
Well, we've got ponies up here. We sell colts and ride pony pen time. So I guess, yes, I guess you'd call it a business, but it's very poor business. It's like many other farming endeavors. Farming is not too prosperous occupation anymore. It costs as much to feed them in the winter and other expenses, related expenses, and you make out of the sale of the ponies. The labor of love, I guess you call it.
That's right. Well, I think we're very grateful to you this morning for having answered all of our questions.
What is that?
We're grateful to you this morning.
Well, thank you.
Thank you very much for answering some questions we had.
One thing that might be of some interest, it used to be when pony penning evolved, penning the ponies on acetate and Wallace Beach. After they finished penning the ponies on acetate, they'd load the riding horses on a barge, take it to Wallace Beach, pin the ponies on Wallace Beach, all the same day.
Wow.
So they'd finish their pony penning and be late at night on pony penning swim day before they finished.
Now, did they auction them, all of them then?
No, they did not auction.
Now, what did they
do? Auction came later. They used to sell them, I think it was, well, I can remember when they sold for anywhere from $10, $25 each. That was, I guess, in the late 30s, early 40s. They didn't start auctioning them until maybe sometime in the 50s.
Well, what was the purpose of their penning them then?
To get rid of the young colts.
And what did they do with the colts?
Sold them.
They sold them, but they just didn't auction.
No, they sold them privately.
I see.
In other words, you go there and pick up one, they say, well, that's 25 or 50 or... And then they got up to $100. That was considered big money. So I was a strong advocate of auction. And I had a lot of opposition in the fire company, people who did not want to go to auction. So the rest of the story is kind of self-evident. Now they're bringing as much as $4,000, $5,000 apiece as a result of the auction. Average price is now around $1,600. So.
And people come back year after year, don't they?
Yes.
Isn't it amazing?
Yes.
And from the early days, did the fire company get the income from the sale of the ponies?
Not in the early days, not when Mr. Pruitt owned them, but they didn't.
Did they go to Mr. Pruitt?
No, and they went to, when Mr. Pruitt, they settled his estate. They had the horses penned, they had penned them on acetate, and they took them over to Greenbackville and put them in his corral over there, and that's where they sold them off. The fire company bought a lot of them at that sale and put them back on acetate.
Do you have any other stories you can relate to us?
Well,
you're looking at your ponies, I see.
Yeah. I used to, as a kid, I used to go with them on the penning of both Assateague and Wallace Beach. And I was not maybe 10, 12 years old then. But I've been following the ponies all my life, including having ponies up here. Of course, the children now, take care of them. They've been brought up all their lives around ponies, and they're familiar with them.
And you have quite a small grandson, I understand, who comes up and visits you regularly and walks home.
Well, he's... all of my grandchildren have been sort of low temperament and not too active, but he's a turtle. He's into everything and constantly on the move and has very much a will of his own.
We want to thank you very much. We're going to conclude our interview with you this morning now.
All right.
And we're grateful to you.